From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about community activist Mama Freeman and her work in Milwaukee's Garden Homes community. Then we'll tell you about a program that helps veterans manage stress through yoga.
The type of yoga that we landed on is very much a mindfulness-based program that uses gentle movements that we thought would be more approachable and doable for our vets.
We'll learn about Milwaukee's Healing Spaces Initiative.
After the pandemic, a lot of problems have been brought to light as far as mental health, and to have these spaces where people can regroup and center themselves, I think that's very beneficial.
Plus, learn the real story behind Wisconsin's dueling brands, Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. If you're driving through Milwaukee's Garden Homes community, you may find Martha Mama Freeman. The anti-violence community activist has become such a fixture of the neighborhood, they even named a street after her. Mama Freeman has spent most of her life working for the community, as a crossing guard, a teacher, a community builder, and now as a pastor at Alpha Omega Ministries. I had a chance to speak with Mama Freeman at her home about what inspired her to become an anti-violence activist.
I've always had a desire to work with youth. That led me to becoming a crossing guard. And when I left that, I went to UWM and I ended up being a teacher for Milwaukee Public Schools. And I was teaching the emotionally disturbed and delinquent children. And that continued on until I started working at the House of Correction. I worked there for 20 years. It's really a heartbreaker because you see the anger and the violence outside of the prison. You see the same thing inside the prison. And I always wanted to find a solution, a way to work with, you know, the people. I know what it's like to have a bad temper, you know, where you just go off at about anything. But when I began to work at the House Correction, I think I was more into it than in the school and in, you know, crossing guard. You're right there with violence, with hurt people, people who have been hurt, people who have hurt others. And I think that was really my motivator.
What was it about the people who you met inside of the House of Corrections that really made you think something needs to change?
I worked third shift. I liked that shift because it got me into a position where I could talk to inmates. You know, at night it was quiet. You know, most of them were laying down. But late at night, I would be able to talk to those that were really troubled. They didn't have to put on the big front, you know. I talked to a lot of them that were suicidal. A lot of them were afraid. You know, you get to talk to them about, how did you get here? You know, what made you come this far? And I think that working with them during those hours gave me a need to try and find some solutions, try and find ways that they could, you know, get through the time that they had, and then on the outside, you know, would have something positive to follow up on. Late at night, you would see a different person. You know, some of them that you thought were so tough and rough during the day, at night it wasn't like that. You know, they would sit, some would cry, and it just changed my whole perspective. Just wanted to see if I could help them get out and help them stay out.
So much of your work has become linked with the Garden Homes community. Why is this community so important to you?
Back in 1969, I was living with my mother-in-law and my husband, who is deceased now. and it was just a hard life. I didn't get along with him. My husband just wasn't, things weren't right. So I got a divorce. And they were giving away houses for people who needed houses. And I applied and I got a house. It's beautiful now. Oh my God, I walked past it. It's so pretty. But anyway, they gave me this house on 26th Street in the 4300 block, right around the corner from my church. And I loved it because right in the middle of the block, there's a street on this side, then a park, and on the other side is a street. And I used to take my kids out there and play, and then I ended up playing with all of the kids in the neighborhood, and they would all come, and we would just do things, you know, fashion shows, basketball, watermelon eating contests, just fun kinds of things. And I would take them through the neighborhood, cleaning up the neighborhood. I think that's why they put that my name on the street there. It was a place where I would dream about, you know, my own house, and not to have to take my children far away. The park was right there. I just loved that neighborhood because I was in need then, you know, when I got that house. And I don't even know how to explain the feeling that I had, but, you know, it was mine, and it was in a nice place. And I just learned to love that neighborhood and the people around there. And like now, I know practically everybody that lives there because I watched them grow up from kids to grown ups. So my church was right there, and now I have my own church there. And so I was able to stay there and open up the restaurant. And then from the restaurant, I'm working on opening a thrift shop with one of the places. So it's just being right there in a neighborhood where I honestly believe that the Lord put me there, because it seems like if there's a problem on the street, I can just walk over there and go, now what? What are you guys doing? You know, I'm just able to talk to them, talk them out of, you know, some of the violence, and that does my heart good.
It seems like all of this work really speaks to building a community, building a neighborhood in which people respect one another, in which people appreciate one another's humanity. In your view, how important is that to reducing violence, especially in the city of Milwaukee?
I think it's very important. I talk to Alderman Ashanti a lot, and he works with me so much, you know. I guess what I think is, if we could bring that kind of change, it would be peaceful, you know, like instead of talking about someone, oh, isn't she, look at her clothes, look at that. It would be the reverse. You would say, hey, I got this. Or they come to me now and say, Miss Freeman, do you have a pair of pants, or do you have a dress? I messed mine up. Or, you know, and just to be able to say, here's a dress. Come in and take a look and see if you can find something. Believe it or not, they don't do it right in front of the church where I am. I can be sitting there and they'll be walking by. You know how the fellas have their pants sagging. They'll start pulling them up and they look at me and laugh, you know. That to me says, I know that my pants are down, but I respect you, so I pull them up. And I said that to say that I think that's the kind of respect that's needed in neighborhoods, where people respect one another and they'll do what's right, you know. Because I know I can't just go out there and beat up somebody and say, pull your pants up. No. So if they're pulling their pants up and smiling at me, especially from the younger kids all the way up to adults, to have those 18, 19-year-olds speak to you, respect you like that, there's something inside of them, you know, because nowadays it's so much evil, so much violence, you know. I know it can be changed. I don't know how to begin other than to start talking to people and seeing what their problems are. You know, and I think that if you can reach one, then that one will reach another. It's just going to take a lot of work, you know, but it can be done. I really believe that. Because there's change in that little neighborhood already. Sometimes I have to laugh at myself to know, just thinking about some of the things that I do, you know. I mean, just confronting a whole crowd of people or taking a gun from somebody. Sometimes I have to step back and take a look at myself and say, who do you think you are? But it's not for a banner or a big head or anything. It's just that I love people. And I just can see, I can see good in people, you know. Might take a lot to bring it out, you know. But I think that I can see myself in a lot of people. I think when I was younger, I can remember things said to me like, you're never going to be nothing. Why do you do this and why do you do that? I think until I got it in my head, I don't have to be who they think I am. You know, I can be who I really want to be deep inside of me. I want to be this kind of person. And I think when I started to deal with myself that way, I was able to make a change, a big change. I never thought that I would be a pastor. I never thought I would have my name on the street. I never thought, I didn't reach for goals like that. But honestly, I just think that working with those that are in positions like alderman and senator and those kind of people, I think that there's hope there. And I don't know if any of my little suggestions are going to make a big change. I'm hoping so.
Mama or Mother Martha Freeman is the pastor at Alpha Omega Ministries and a community peacemaker who can frequently be found in Milwaukee's Garden Homes neighborhood. PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, often affects veterans. With limited treatment options and barriers to getting help, PTSD often goes untreated. But two researchers at Marquette University are using exercise as an alternative accessible option. They're using yoga as both a mental and physical stress reliever. In a recent program with a group of veterans, they explored how mindful physical activity could change how the brain handles stress. Rachel Bollert is an assistant clinical professor of exercise science in the Department of Physical Therapy, and Jacqueline Fitzgerald is an assistant professor of psychology. They join Lake Effect's Mallory Chang.
Just to start off to define what this is, what is PTSD and what are some symptoms of it?
Yeah, so PTSD stands for post-traumatic stress disorder, and it, you know, is actually the most commonly diagnosed disorder for individuals who experience trauma. Now, it's important to note that actually most people who experience a traumatic event in their lifetime, so this is actually a big proportion of the U.S. population, about 90% of U.S. adults will experience trauma at any point in their lifetime. You know, the good news is actually that a lot of people are quite resilient to it. Only about 7 to 9% of individuals will go on to have a PTSD diagnosis. But for individuals who do, we're talking about symptoms of dysregulated mood, problems with processing emotions, perhaps in instances of aggression. We also have characteristic traumatic flashbacks or re-experiencing the traumatic event.
Yeah, and both of you focus specifically on how veterans were impacted by PTSD. Why explore this specific population?
So veterans, you know, is actually one of the biggest populations who do have PTSD. There are lots of other populations, so a lot of our work is also in traumatic injury survivors. But in terms of veterans, so these are individuals who have either gone off to serve in conflicts, but we also do see a lot of PTSD incidents in individuals who are here in the U.S., but who have served in some way in the armed forces. So for us, it's a big population to serve. We know that, you know, a lot of training and preparation goes in for these individuals to prepare them for their work and to prepare them for conflict, but still considerably less is done to serve these individuals back home after they return in terms of making sure that their mental health is the best that it can be. So for us, it's really an issue of trying to maximally serve this population who really needs it.
What does access to therapy or exercise for veterans here in Southeast Wisconsin when coming back from conflict or after their time in the armed forces?
You know, we actually didn't know that question when we started the project. This is actually one of the interesting aspects of our research is we actually went into the community here in Southeastern Wisconsin to get a sense of where services that were geared towards exercise as a therapeutic, would that be needed, helpful, and would people be, you know, interested in it? And what we found is we surveyed at about 100 veterans in this community, and we found that the majority of them were interested in some sort of what we consider alternative therapy. So not your standard, you know, going into a clinical office and getting psychotherapy or even pharmacotherapy like medications, but something that we'd consider alternative like exercise. About half of the veterans that we surveyed were using some sort of clinical service at the VA, but that means about half of them were not. And to be clear, the vast majority of the individuals that we surveyed did have or meet criteria for PTSD. And so that tells us that there's a sizable amount of individuals who would benefit from alternative therapies that aren't seeking services through traditional areas like the VA.
And I'm just curious too, I know both of you focus on in your own personal research about the impact of exercise and neuroscience. Why start with yoga to help treat PTSD symptoms? And generally, what's that relationship with movement and dealing with trauma and dealing with the stress associated with that trauma?
So we know kind of fairly little about kind of that association, to be honest. So the reason we kind of chose, there's been some research that have looked at physical activity in PTSD and in trauma, more so just in the general population. Obviously others, as Jacqueline mentioned, can suffer from PTSD outside of just the veteran population, but just in veterans themselves, there is very much a lack of research examining those benefits or that association. And kind of one of the reasons that we specifically focused on yoga as a modality of activity is, you know, yoga really incorporates, right, two different aspects of physical health and promoting physical wellness and physical fitness, along with mental wellness and fitness. And the specific yoga program that we decided to use really incorporated what they call this mindful resilience aspect of it. And so studying, right, how that approach using yoga as a single modality can really potentially show benefits with both physical and mental health.
Yeah, that's exactly true. I think I'll add one more piece too, which is that we have to be mindful that the veteran community in particular might be suffering from comorbid diagnoses, specifically with chronic pain issues. And we wanted to find something that would be therapeutic physically, as Rachel stated, but wouldn't be necessarily all demanding physically. So the type of yoga that we landed on is very much a mindfulness-based program that uses gentle movements that we thought would be more approachable and doable for our vets in our study. And we did find that they thought it was quite positive. And it's something that each person can come and do the best that they can do in that one session, but it doesn't demand that everybody is, for instance, lifting the same amount of weight.
I did want to add just one thing quickly as well, is that a couple of years ago, I conducted a focus group with some veterans in the area as well and talked really a little bit more about physical activity and their experiences. And one thing that surprised me when kind of learning more about their thoughts and experiences was, you know, they're so used to when they were going through basic training or being in the military of doing this forced high intensity exercise, right? And they developed this negative association, right, with someone telling them they need to do something that they don't really enjoy, whether it's the intensity of it or the type of movement. And so being cognizant of that as well, of, you know, what can we offer them that's something that may elicit more positive emotions and positive responses, and also the opposite to potentially what they experienced. And so that kind of provided kind of more incentive to offer yoga as a modality.
Yeah, I was wondering that. I was wondering why yoga and not like weightlifting or CrossFit. But that definitely makes sense. Going back to this research, just generally, what were some of the reactions from the participants of this program? And are there any plans to expand it or continue it in the near future?
So we actually did a focus group at the end of our study because it's, you know, this is our first kind of step into this type of research. And because it is very new to this community and new to us, we wanted to get a sense directly from the participants. And I would say that in large part, we had, you know, very positive feedback about the program. People who enrolled and completed, and I should say we had a very excellent response rate in the sense that people went through a 12-week program and did it quite regularly. People really enjoyed coming into a space where they knew that other people in that space had their shared identity, but which they were not necessarily required to engage in conversation. They were really there for themselves, right? To take care, as Rachel stated, to really work on improving their physical and mental health and well-being. But nevertheless, they were doing it in a shared identity space. And then kind of to the point earlier, I think the other positive that came out of this is that people found that they could use bits and pieces of the program almost as tools in their toolkit to take back with them when they got home or out of the end of the program to use in their daily life to come back to these principles. We have a lot of data that we're still getting into in terms of what is actually the neurobiological changes in these individuals. We took a lot of assays about, you know, stress hormones, what's the stress hormone system looking like. We have a lot of physical fitness metrics that we're looking at. And so we're hoping to see a little bit of movement in those as well that might correspond to these positive experiences that we heard. From a public standpoint, I think we understand that exercise or physical activity is good. From a research standpoint, I think specifically when we're talking about how neurobiologically do these changes happen, physically, how do these changes happen, and how does this correlate with mood? Specifically, that line is not at all clear. And so, you know, we're trying to kind of marry these two worlds in terms of we hear a lot of feedback of these programs work, and we're trying to figure out what are the mechanics that make them work. If we understand the mechanics, then the hope is eventually we can understand better why some people get much better therapeutic therapy from these types of interventions and why it might not work as effective in other individuals. So really trying to tap into that precision better is a future goal.
The definite need that's there in fostering or thinking about these types of programs and thinking about how we can establish these in the community and also make these known throughout the community of services that are offered. I'm always a proponent of promoting physical activity and talking about the benefits. And, you know, there's been a big shift lately too of thinking a little bit differently about exercise and physical activity, right? Exercise and being active doesn't always need to be going to the gym for 30 minutes and doing a high intensity type of activity. You know, it can be more of a promotion of physical activity and more lighter types of exercise like yoga and incorporating some of those mindfulness aspects as well. You know, our goal is to hopefully make people more aware in our community of the importance of offering programs like this.
Thank you both, Jacqueline and Rachel, for being here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you. Thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Rachel Bollert is an assistant clinical professor of exercise science in the Department of Physical Therapy. And Jacqueline Fitzgerald is an assistant professor of psychology at Marquette University. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. You may have heard the alleged dueling origins of Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet, but what you heard is almost certainly a lie. In about 10 minutes, we are setting the record straight and exploring the true origins of these Wisconsin icons. But first, we'll tell you about an effort to transform vacant lots on Milwaukee's north side into spaces for healing and tranquility. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. There's an effort underway in Milwaukee to turn blighted areas into spaces for healing. It's aptly called the Healing Spaces Initiative. The idea is to turn vacant lots in Milwaukee's Harambe neighborhood into spaces of calm and community. The program has brought together local leaders, politicians, and residents to decide what the spaces should look like or include, like a library, garden, or benches for meditation. WUWM's Eddie Morales speaks with Angela Mitchell-Reed, the community outreach liaison for the City of Milwaukee, about how this initiative has transformed vacant lots on the city's north side.
Can you talk about why the program was started in 2021?
Initially, the program was started just based off of a current program we have called CIP, Community Improvement Project. Frank Cumberbatch from the Bader Philanthropies, he's on our board, and he's such a big fan of CIP. He thought that we could do a new initiative based around healing, calming environments, green spaces on the vacant lots that the city has. And he's in touch with Alderwoman Cox, Lele Cox, and then we came up with a plan, a vision for how we can transform these vacant lots into spaces that are beneficial to the community and to, in particular, to neighbors and to improve the look of blocks, neighborhood blocks.
How are the projects funded?
The projects are funded for 2022 through the city's budget. $50,000 was allocated, and that was due to Alderwoman Cox putting a footnote into the budget to require a $50,000 amount to fund this program. In 2021, the program was funded completely from Bader Philanthropies for $70,000.
So as of right now, how many neighborhoods have healing spaces completed and how many are being worked on at the moment?
So from 2021, we have 8 that have been completed. We have 2 to complete this year by September. And then we have 3 additional ones that we're doing in 2022.
How else are the specific areas, the neighborhoods, the lots, how are those decided on?
Well, we kind of vet the lots. Once we put an open call, basically a request for a proposal out to neighborhood residents, community groups, nonprofits, we have them complete an application, and then we vet the application by their connection to the neighborhood. If there's neighborhood community groups, nonprofits in the area who have an interest in investing in spaces that are close to their nonprofits. In addition, we look at how many lots are in a small area that have not been utilized or developed or activated. And once we get a feel for that number, then we just basically work with the residents to see what their visions are for the space. And if that's something we can bring to fruition, then they move forward in the process. And then we review all the applications and the merits of their application. In particular, we're looking for involvement of the neighbors because we want them to take ownership. We want them to have a sense of community, a sense of healing in those spaces. So that's why it depends a lot on what the residents want to have in those spaces. Even though the city has a plan, we have an idea of some of the amenities to bring to the spaces, it's really left up to the residents and if they can execute the project with our help of a main contractor.
What do some of those specific spaces look like before any work is done? And then after, what is it that the residents are able to benefit from the space when it's been worked on?
So the spaces are basically blank canvases, or they're areas that have been neglected. They may be illegal dumping spaces, a lot of trash, a lot of construction debris, or they're just underutilized spaces that the city just makes sure they mow each year and they also plow each year. But other than that, there's nothing there. And so our vision is to create something that attracts the public. And after the spaces have been developed out, basically, the residents have all types of amenities there, benches, healing gardens. These spaces are comfort spaces. They're supposed to be places of peace and calm. Even if it's just a block down the street from where you may live, you want to come and sit in a space that's kind of quiet and just relaxing. And that's our whole hope for these healing spaces. After the pandemic, I think a lot of problems have been brought to light as far as mental health, and to have these spaces where people can kind of just regroup and center themselves, I think that's very beneficial. And that's the hope for all of these healing spaces, is for people to have a place of calm and relaxation.
Have you heard of any specific stories from residents of how they've used the spaces and how maybe that has helped them heal in ways?
There's this one older lady who helped us on several projects. She's a gardener. That's her thing. So she came out and helped us plant a lot of perennials last year. And she told us that she just goes and sits in the space. Like, she'll take her daily walk and she'll just end up sitting in the space that's down the street from her house and kind of people watching the traffic and enjoying the space. And that's exactly what we want. We want to have stories like that shared with us. Because that's why we created these spaces, to be activated, not vacant spaces where people feel that they can't be transformed into something beautiful. We want these spaces to be something of a respite for individuals. And that's what she shared with us on her walks. She'll take a walk and sit there and just relax herself.
So residents have the opportunity to voice what they would like to see in these spaces, and that's through the Healing Spaces Initiative visioning sessions. Can you talk about how those visioning sessions have helped shape what the developments look like and what people can look forward to in future visioning sessions?
Currently, the visioning sessions are headed by our main contractor, Groundwork Milwaukee, and the Green Team. And we come to the table with ideas of amenities, suggestions for amenities, because we do have a budget for each site and we have to stay within the budget. So we give ideas of potential amenities. However, as far as the way that the space is then developed and shaped, it's solely on the merits of what the individuals want, the residents want. So some may want a backless bench. Maybe we had a donation of trees and someone decided to use the trees to create the benches, the backless benches. Okay, that's one idea that we've had proposed. You know, we had thought maybe we just use metal benches, because one thing that's top of mind is making sure every space is ADA compliant. It has to be accessible to everyone because it is a public space that's funded publicly. So we have to be able to have those who are physically challenged be able to get through on the pathways, whether they be concrete or red granite with bonding, those who use walkers or rollators or someone even on crutches. So that's top of mind, first of all. And then what would you like? You may want a fence, but a fence gives the impression we want to keep people out. We want to welcome people in. And so maybe we don't use fences. Maybe we use arvitae trees that can serve as a border. It still frames out the space, but it also still welcomes you in. Maybe there's a sensory garden with lemongrass and lavender and things like that are very relaxing and calming. So we propose those ideas to individuals, and then they come back and give us their ideas or their feedback or their suggestions. So while the visioning sessions are scheduled by us and they're led by our contractors, it's really an opportunity for the residents to tell us what they want and what they need in these spaces. And what we hope for the future is to continue to have the same level of communication with the residents, telling us what they want. We don't want to take over or create a program and then take it over and say, this is what you can have. We are so open to the creativity of the City of Milwaukee residents that a lot of our projects that are not healing spaces, but our community improvement projects are based off the creativity of residents. So we want to still have that line of communication open for future visioning sessions. Tell us what you think you can see here, what you envision here, and we'll try and make it happen.
And so even though this started as a result of the pandemic and people feeling isolated, this is something that's going to carry on in future years.
We certainly hope so. Certainly it's based on funding. If funding continues in the city's budget, we are still continuing to reach out to partners who can help financially or who can help fund the projects. Certainly, there's an opportunity to partner again with Bader Philanthropies, but certainly we are looking at other opportunities for public funding. We certainly receive funding from AARP for the Healing Spaces, a $25,000 grant. So we are certainly looking for opportunities to partner with other funding sources. I think Healing Spaces is a great initiative, and we are so proud of this initiative. From where we started a conversation to where it's gone now, almost 2 years later, we couldn't imagine the level of success and the level of communication and partnership with the residents and nonprofits of the City of Milwaukee. So we certainly welcome those opportunities in the future, and we certainly hope that we have Healing Spaces 3.0 in 2023.
Well, thank you so much, Angela Mitchell-Reed. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Eddie.
Angela Mitchell-Reed is the Community Outreach Liaison for the City of Milwaukee. She spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales. Fleet Farm and Farm & Fleet are among the most beloved brands from Wisconsin, and with good reason. Where else can you buy an enormous bag of candy, a new pair of jeans, and a baby chick all at the same time? But there is a persistent myth plaguing the legacy of these two stores, one that frames them as dueling brands forever locked in a battle for dominance. So we're here to set the record straight with Archer Parkett, managing editor of Milwaukee Magazine, who wrote a story about the origins of these brands in this month's issue. Archer, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Starting into this story, it reminded me a lot of a story I did a while back on the origins of the word bubbler. Similarly, there's this persistent myth in the case of the bubbler that Kohler invented the term when someone there designed a drinking fountain. But the whole thing is bunk. There are no records of this supposed designer, and Kohler wasn't even doing plumbing at the time. Yet you'll still hear people repeating this claim and really sticking to it. What I found fascinating about Farm & Fleet, or Fleet Farm, they have a very similar legend with that same kind of allegiance. Can you explain a bit about that?
Yes, definitely. I think that's a great example, the bubbler story. What really makes the legend interesting is how devoted people are to it. So there are different versions of the legend, but the most common that I've heard is that Fleet Farm and Farm & Fleet originated with two different brothers, or at least distant relatives, and that they had both started it together, started it for a few years, and then had some sort of big feud that maybe it was over a girl they both liked, or they had different ideas about the business. And they got in such a big fight that they split it up. There was some legal action involved, and they had to branch out into different parts of Wisconsin and change their name. So that's why we have such similar names, Fleet Farm and Farm & Fleet. The other version of the legend that's most common is that it was a couple who started it and that the couple divorced and that they had to split the store in the divorce settlement and had that same name change thing in the end. That myth has been persistent in Wisconsin for the 6 or 7 decades that those stores have been around.
It seems like regardless of the relationship at the center of it, there is this idea that there was this big rupture that caused the branching off of these competing Farm & Fleets and or Fleet Farms. The actual story has a lot more to do with tax law than I'd anticipated, but it does include brothers, two sets of them, in fact. How do we come to have this dueling, as it were, Farm & Fleet and Fleet Farm?
Yeah, the actual story, strangely enough, the two franchises are quite parallel. Both franchises started in 1955. Two sets of brothers, Bert and Claude Blaine and Stu and Hank Mills. The Blaine brothers, they were in their middle age at the time. They owned car dealerships throughout Wisconsin. And the Mills brothers were much younger. I believe they were in their 20s. They were the sons of Stuart Mills, who had his own auto company as well, selling cars. So what happened in the 50s were there were these very stringent minimum markup laws in Wisconsin. We still have some of those laws, but they're not nearly as strict as they were back then. So back then, retailers could not sell things at much of a discount at all. It was considered unfair. They all had to mark things at the same price. One of the only exceptions was for customers who owned a fleet, which meant that they had 5 or more internal combustion engines. So the way that was defined, it could be cars, tractors, even a couple of lawnmowers counted. So at the time, the people who had that many engines in Wisconsin were farmers. And so both the Mills and the Blaine brothers realized that they could get around these markup laws by focusing on the people who had fleet cards, farmers. So what they both did was they started their own stores. The Mills brothers started in Marshfield and the Blaine brothers started in Janesville. Their goal was to sell farm supplies to people with fleet cards. So they were offering these goods at just prices way better than a normal store could offer. And it really was sort of a genius idea at the time. And that's where part of the dueling aspect comes into play, is the idea of who came up with it first. Was it the Mills brothers or the Blaine brothers? And once I started to look into it, that conflict goes even further. they both joined the Mid-States Co-op, which was a group of multiple stores with the same business model, ran by a couple called Bob and Jean Kiesow. And to this day, the Mid-States Co-op claims they came up with the idea. So the Mills brothers, the Blaine brothers, and the co-op all sort of at this point lay claim to having come up with the idea originally. But yeah, in 1955, they both started their first store selling to folks with fleet cards.
It's interesting that there are these two sets of brothers who have started stores. There isn't that kind of rupture at the center. And what I found even more interesting is they weren't the only fighting fleet farmers, as it were. There were a variety of them in the state. Do you have any idea how many there were?
There were dozens pushing 70 to 80 around the Midwest in that late 50s, early 60s time. Because it was just such a great idea, because there was no other way to market these discount goods at the time. But yeah, I looked up some of the old documents about some of these places. There was Farm and Fleet Field Service, Quality Farm and Fleet Supply, Dinsmore Farm and Fleet, Steve's Farm and Fleet. They were all over. It was not just the two that have grown into the sort of Wisconsin behemoths.
Well, and that really gets to what they are now. They are these kinds of behemoths. They may have had these, you know, I don't know if you would even call them humble origins, because both of these sets of brothers came from relatively well-off families, but they are in many ways the last remaining fleet farm venturers, as it were. Perhaps even more oddly, even though they were competing, it seems like they had a friendly relationship.
Yes, actually. I spoke to some of the folks who still work at those stores. Unfortunately, both sets of brothers have passed on since then. But yeah, everyone reports friendly relations between the families. There's really no one who says that there was any rivalry outside of, you know, the basics of business. In fact, some of the folks who knew the brothers told me that like Bert and Stu Mills were actually pretty good friends. The personal aspect of the rivalry really does not have any basis in reality that I could tell.
Now, here's, I think, the final question. Do you think Wisconsinites are ready for the real story of Farm and Fleet / Fleet Farm?
You know, I don't know, because the real story is just not quite as fun as the fake one. My favorite part of the story was talking to people from the stores and just hearing how often people would tell them their version of the legend and insist that it was real. Even people who knew the original brothers, who had been there for decades, would have customers who just would not listen and insist that it was this personal split. I think it's just a great story. It's very unique that we have these similarly named stores that are so well-loved and have such strong fan bases. And I think the fact that there's this legend adds a whole another layer to it, and the reality's a little bit less fun. But yeah, I think once people learn the real story, it actually is kind of interesting in its own way. The way it developed out of these legal loopholes and the way they've grown their business and become this real cultural Wisconsin touchstone, I think.
For sure. Well, Archer, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Great, thank you.
Archer Parquette is the managing editor of Milwaukee Magazine. You can find a link to his article at WUWM.com. And while you're there, you can also find my Bubbler Talk piece exploring the true origins of the word bubbler. We'll hear from soccer fans in Milwaukee ahead of this weekend's first ever soccer game at Lambeau Field. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. For the first time ever, the Green Bay Packers are opening up Lambeau Field for another sport, soccer. Two of the world's leading international football or soccer teams will be taking over the turf this Saturday. Bayern Munich, the most successful club in German history, is taking on Manchester, or Man City. They're the reigning champions of England's Premier League. Ahead of the matchup, WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke to fans of both teams at Bayview's Highbury Pub and Bavarian Inn in Glendale.
We're heading into the Bavarian Beer House. There are murals on the wall, the King Room, the Tap Room. Ah, we
have... So I was in Munich at the stadium for our what was our 90th anniversary, and I had reached out to some people at Bayern Munich and said, it would be great if we could get something. We've been a German-American club for 90 years. So I got to meet Karl-Heinz Rummenigge. They gave me the uniform that he signed. He was their president at the time, played for Bayern, played for the German national team, and he signed this jersey for us that we have framed here today.
In red.
In Bavarian red. In Bayern red.
I think I'm just excited to be at a soccer game live. I've never been to a soccer game of this caliber. I've been to MLS games, but nothing like this. So I'm just excited to be there and witness it, especially in Lambeau Field, because we go to Packer games all the time. So it'll be cool to see Lambeau used like for a different crowd and a different event.
And what do you think about this cultural exchange of like people coming from a soccer background into such a quintessential football town?
I think it's really neat. I mean, he's talking to people who are coming from Australia, who are coming to, you know, Green Bay, Wisconsin, like this tiny little town. And, you know, I think the Packers have a lot of notoriety and a lot of cultural significance, and even internationally to an extent. But I think having people who are either from other parts of the country or international come to just rural Wisconsin for this event, I think it's really special.
So can you weigh in on what you're expecting, like with people like your family who lives in Green Bay and other people that just are just so rock solid Green Bay pride, and then having like this inflection?
Yeah, I mean, I think it, from what it sounds like, and they were also kind of speaking about people that they've talked to up there, there's a lot of excitement. It's such a unique thing. Like, it is the first one that's ever been done there. So I think there's a lot of excitement of people that aren't even going to go to the match, that are going to want to explore what's going on before, maybe learn a bit, little bit more about the two clubs. Where are they even coming from? Because, I mean, some people know that it's a soccer match. Some people know that it's a team from England versus a team from Germany. Some people know it's Manchester City versus Bayern Munich. But no matter where they fall on that spectrum of knowledge about the match, it's generated interest, and it's going to generate a lot of people kind of hanging around the stadium and potentially learning more and maybe becoming fans in the long run. When you think about American football versus world football and the fans during games and the environment there, I mean, I go to Packer games all the time. I love American football, and the environment's great. There's so much stoppage in American football that you're constantly going to hear a PA announcer coming on to get the crowd hyped up. Go Pack, go! Or a new song to bring energy to the stadium. Whereas during a soccer match, the fans are carrying the tune. Like, there are songs, there are chants, there are drums, there are instruments. It's a completely different energy, and it's all built from the fans. It's not manufactured from loudspeakers and coaching from a PA announcer. So I'm really interested to see how much of that is brought up to Lambeau.
What's a typical Man City tune? Like, I don't know, for someone who has zero knowledge of
this. One of the biggest songs for the team is Blue Moon.
Blue Moon.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And Hey Jude is a big one. Oasis has a few songs because from Manchester, and one of the brothers, at least, I think both are team fans.
We've got this big exhibition. It's the first time that there's, you know, a soccer game at Lambeau, historic Lambeau Fields in Green Bay, for the first time ever. What's your take on that? It's two top-tier European League teams. What do you think about it?
I think it's great. I think it's a great opportunity for Wisconsin to showcase its soccer, you know, history, its background, to get out and support Bayern and Man City, and to show that the community is really behind soccer as a sport.
And what do you think it means that soccer is sort of taking over this, like, quintessential football town, like American football town? What are you expecting?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really shows how far the game has come in this country and in Wisconsin. To have an opportunity to play at Lambeau Field is definitely historic. It may or may not happen again. So to have teams like Bayern and City there to play is truly a historical opportunity for the members of the community and for the state to get out and support the game.
That was WUWM's Mayon Silver speaking with soccer fans ahead of the matchup at Lambeau Field this Saturday. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Mallory Chang join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Kate Flynn and Chase Browning. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. This week, we also heard from Mayon Silver, Chuck Kornbach, Emily Files, and Susan Bentz from the WUWM News Team. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Matternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. Join us again on Monday at noon for a discussion with Disability Rights Wisconsin on how people living with a disability will be impacted by voter drop boxes being removed from the state. And Bubbler Talk looks into the origins of the lion statues outside the Frank Zeidler Municipal Building in downtown Milwaukee. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you so much for joining us today on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.